You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamaria, ko Kelly Enright Tokuingoa, and welcome to this week's bits. Lachlan spoke with Shadow Leader of the House Simon Bridges about the confusion over the election of Trevor Mallard to Speaker. He also spoke with Dr. Stephen Winter from the University of Auckland about the role of select committees and what significance the increase in seats from 96 to 108 will have.
Basically, what happened was members of Parliament were being sworn in, and that occurred, and it was apparent to me and to others of my colleagues, you know, amongst the 56 National MPs, that there were a number of several, really, government members who weren't present. And so members who had not been sworn in were unable to vote. And so we thought that, you know, it was important, you know, as our, in our job as a loyal opposition that tests the competence of a government to look at maybe testing that. Of course, what also happened is we were very, very annoyed, frankly, at the way we had been treated over a number of issues, particularly around select committees. And so it was an agreement. We had always wanted more members on select committees, because we were going to go to the lowest numbers in history, and we just didn't think that was right in any way. And so, you know, what happened was senior Labor members on working all of this out, we came to an agreement. You know, it's a pretty dramatic sort of a thing to happen, and then a new speaker could be elected because we effectively, in looking to test the government's competence, you know, found it to be a bit wanting, got some things we thought were important we should have got all along anyway, and had proven our point and, you know, taught the new government a lesson.
You are meant to hold the government to account, but I mean, sort of testing their number skills, I mean, isn't it more of just a kind of a cynical political move, this?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I was very annoyed about what happened in the weeks prior, where, you know, people refer to the standing orders report and the talk about 96 there, but that was in a situation where my party, the governing party at the time, was reaching out to do what the opposition parties wanted. They were fundamentally actually trying to create a more MMP Parliament, and they thought that smaller committees would make it do a better job. I get that, but what was also true is those numbers didn't disadvantage them as opposition parties because there were more smaller ones. And in taking the approach saying, no, we're sticking with that, and you can get stuffed, which is effectively the position that was being put to us, and you'll have a lot of MPs who won't be able to be on select committees and hold the government to account and scrutinise what government is doing through that engine room of select committees. That meant that I'd made it quite clear to the new government that we would be looking to test them in this way and to do so strongly. And there was the opportunity for us to do that on the Tuesday, and that's ultimately what we did. We got, of course, what we should have got anyway, and that now means we were able to get things back to a bit more of an even keel, where we still hold the government to account, we still scrutinise, because that's our constitutional role ultimately. But we, you know, there's also some reasonableness. So this talk about, as you sort of put it, I can't remember the words you used, but cynical and so on, I totally reject.
That was Simon Bridges chatting to producer Lachlan. We now have producer Connor, who caught up with Professor Jane Kelsey from the University Auckland Law Department. Kelsey updated us on the recent developments in negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and discussed possible motivations for states to pursue or reject the deal.
Is it realistic to think that 10, 11 or more or so countries can have an agreement of this nature when they run domestic institutions which change every 3 to 4 or 5 years depending on their term? Because just in the process of negotiation, we've seen America pull out, we've seen sort of small turnarounds from New Zealand and Canadian governments, and we're seeing places like Japan really trying to push it from a government that has been in power through the negotiation process. Is it realistic to think that if something was signed, it could actually sustain through the future?
Well, that's the whole purpose of the agreements. The purpose of the agreements is to put handcuffs on governments so that when governments change, albeit with a democratic mandate to do something different, they're pre-committed to maintaining a certain position and that they can suffer either economic sanctions in terms of changing trade rules or financial penalties and damages in the case of foreign investors suing them. That's the whole purpose of this. And so there is a fundamental collision between democracy and the purpose of these agreements, especially when they're conducted in secret. But there's also a fundamental collision between notions of sovereignty, and that one government now can't bind a government of the future, and that states are sovereign to decide their own future direction, and agreements that are designed to remove very significant parts of the autonomy of sovereign states.
Looking at New Zealand, we have seen protests and marches over the last several years about the TPPA. Is this a trend across the countries involved in the agreement, or is this unique to somewhere like New Zealand where it represents part of our culture to be quite active and involved in these sort of things?
There are very different countries involved here. There have been protests in Japan, but Japanese politics is very different from here. In Canada, there has been deep concern, but they've had three of these mega deals that they've been dealing with, one with the EU, now the review of NAFTA plus the TPPA. In Australia, they have a really serious issue there because the Australian Labor Party does not support the TPPA, and they haven't been able to get it through the Senate. And there's a really serious question of whether they will be able to again. In that case, there hasn't been the mass protests that we had here, but there's been a very strong political resistance to the terms of the deal. But if you look much broader around the world, you can see that these kinds of hyper-ambitious deals, we call them mega agreements, are running into trouble because they're so audacious, they're so unbalanced, and they're coming at a time when there is this real resistance, especially after the global financial crisis, to the unbalanced kind of economy and society we have. One really good thing a couple of days ago was that the new Trade Minister, David Parker, himself said, we have to stop just pursuing these agreements for the sake of them and notches in the belt, which was the national government's approach, and we need to think about how these agreements fit within a sustainable economic development model where you deal with these questions of inequality and you deal with climate change and so on. And that's really promising. The problem will be that they will have signed away a lot of the ability to do that if they proceed.
That was producer Connor talking to Professor Jane Kelsey. And finally, Tuesday Wire host India looks at the Paradise Papers, which examine how the world's elite use offshore tax havens. The Paradise Papers are a 30-million-page leak from German journalists, who then handed it to the Investigative Journalism Council to explore.
The Paradise Papers are a huge volume. I think it's over 13 million documents that have arrived as a leak, a set of leaked documents, to originally a group of German journalists who then made it available to the International Council of Investigative Journalism, who were then joined by The Guardian and I think also Panorama, who have spent probably 8 to 9 months going through it in detail. And that's what we've got now. Well, the leaked documents came from particularly one large company that is, I think, primarily a legal firm that is set up specifically just to help people find ways to be able to avoid taxes. Now, we have to remember that that means it's legal, but when you take the whole planet, it's about looking to find where in the world can someone register their business as being based, and therefore that's where they pay taxes. And so ideally this company has gone out of its way to find all the places where there's very little tax to be paid. And a lot of the correspondence backwards and forwards between multinationals and extremely super rich people is actually in these documents.
And it's interesting to see that they implicate some very high-profile people, including Donald Trump and Theresa May and Justin Trudeau's advisor, who have all people who are all have said that this is an issue they want to crack down on. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, they're saying this, but in practice, they're actually sort of complicit in the issue.
Well, one of the things that Oxfam is asking for is more transparency, and I think that it is about ensuring that there isn't hypocrisy amongst our political leaders or even amongst some of the multinationals who's in the past have said that they pay their fair share of taxes, and yet then you do hear that Apple has worked very hard to find ways to be able to pay far less, even though that when they were under pressure to pay fair tax back in 2013, they looked all over the place to find somewhere and set up something specifically in Guernsey to avoid paying fair tax. So I think it's legal, but it's not fair.
So how do you see this, like how should this be addressed? Does it need to be changing the laws? Does it need to be sort of a perception change, or what's the best course of action?
There's a whole range of things that have been flowing from the Panama Papers and some of the leaks before then. And it is first and foremost a growing sense of it being unfair, and that whilst it may be the law, it's actually not moral and not fair when so many of us pay our fair share of taxes, and taxes are what are used to help hospitals and schools and our roading system and law and order. And particularly for Oxfam, that's in developing countries. So what we're seeing is a growing understanding around the world, whether you're in a developing country or in a country like New Zealand, where it's just not okay for this to carry on. So transparency, and that's particularly what Oxfam is asking for, is something called public country-by-country reporting by multinationals, so that we can tell how much they earn in a country and how much tax they pay in that country, and that actually relates to New Zealand in particular. Secondly, we're also looking, and there's been some movement in the EU, around ending tax havens, or at least beginning to be able to build the list of unacceptable tax havens, like a blacklist. And there's very few on that list right now, and it's about actually moving more into that becomes unacceptable. I think thirdly, we're very, very aware too that that organized countries such as New Zealand are setting up tax working groups, and it's about seeing what is feasible to be able to both reduce the amount of legal tax avoidance. After all, the law is passed by our government, so we can actually change law. It's not like it's written in stone. So this is something that as members of our communities and voters all around the world are in a position to be able to put some pressure on our government to say, so if the law allows this to happen, why don't we change some of the law?
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.